This episode is sponsored by World History Encyclopedia, one of the top history websites on the internet. I love the fact they're not a wiki. Every article they publish is reviewed by the editorial team, not only for being accurate, but also for being interesting to read. The website is run as a non-profit organization, so you won't be bombarded by annoying ads, and is completely free. It's a great site, and don't just take my word for it. They've been recommended by many academic institutions, including Oxford University. Go check them out at worldhistory.org or follow the link in the episode description. In the Western world, the Iranian government has long been synonymous with acts of violence and terrorism.
The joint military strikes were in response to nearly 2 months of attacks by the Iran-backed Houthi movement on cargo ships in the Red Sea.
Iran is today the world's leading state sponsor of terror.
Argentina has accused top Iranian officials and a Hezbollah operative of being behind the Amir attack.
When you threaten the region and Israel, you threaten America.
The ongoing conflict in Gaza and the involvement of Iranian-linked militant groups, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Houthis, has drawn renewed attention to Iran's involvement with terrorism. In this episode, I speak with counterterrorism and intelligence expert Matthew Levitt of the Washington Institute. With over two decades of experience, including working for the US Treasury Department and with the FBI, Matthew offers extraordinary insights into the financing, organization, and machinations of terrorist groups, specifically for this episode, those connected with the Iranian regime. Matthew, probably the best known example of Iranian involvement with a terrorist group is its relationship with the Lebanese-based organization Hezbollah. Can you explain the logistics and the origins of this particular relationship?
Right after the Iranian Revolution in 1979, the revolutionary government of the Islamic Republic of Iran established departments and agencies whose dedicated purpose was to export the revolution. The revolution was never intended to stop at the borders of Iran. And the lowest hanging fruit first effort here was in Lebanon, not only because of the sizable population within the Shia community, but because the Lebanese Shia community, the clerics, had such close ties to Iranian clerics, either in Iran or at seminaries in Iraq. In the very early 1980s, 1982, Iran sent some 1,500, we now call them Quds Force, at the time they were better known as Pasdaran, it's the same thing, forces to the Bekaa Valley, where they took over the Sheikh Abdullah barracks and started to kind of coalesce together this motley crew of Shia militant groups. It seems to me that at the time when they first started, the plan wasn't necessarily to create a singular, organized, hierarchical organization. That's what happened in the creation of Hezbollah, literally the party of God. I think in the first instance, they were just trying to get these organizations to operate under a larger umbrella, but it became much more than an umbrella. It was very, very successful because it included ideological training. It included weapons training. It included funding, logistics, and it included actual operations, first in Lebanon, and then very soon after, 1980s, in the Gulf, targeting U.S. and French interests, for example, because the U.S. and France were supporting Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War, and then branching out to Europe, to South America, etc. Without the organization that the Iranians helped create, without the funding and the training, and without that being consistent over time, Lebanese Hezbollah, as we know it today, would be something very different, much smaller, and much less dangerous.
Does the Iranian support for Hezbollah and other groups such as Hamas and the Houthis mean that the Iranian regime is in a position to dictate the operations of this group and directly decide when and where they act?
No. And there's a spectrum of Iranian proxy activity, with Lebanese Hezbollah all the way at one most trusted end. Today, Lebanese Hezbollah is effectively an arm of the Quds Force, the Revolutionary Guards Quds Force, to the farther other end, which is kind of the Houthis, who don't really much like the Iranians. They're a different type of Shia. The Iranians don't much like them, but they're useful to each other. until the founding leader of Hezbollah's terrorist wing, the Islamic Jihad Organization or External Security Organization, Unit 910, these are all names for the same terrorist wing, until Imad Mughniyeh was killed in February 2008, there was one relationship. And Mughniyeh himself was effectively a deputy to the head of the Quds Force. And when the Iranians would come and say, hey, Hezbollah, do this, he was in a position to say, well, maybe that's not the best thing right now. Let's talk about that. When he was assassinated, there was no one who could really take over for him. His cousin and brother-in-law, Mustafa Badruddin, did for a period of time. He was killed in Syria, reportedly for not being close enough to the Iranians and not responding quickly enough to the Iranians. And now no one person has this position. It's kind of run by committee. Talal Hamia, Fuad Shukr, Imad Akal. Some of these people are more capable than others, but they're not in a position to push back like they once did on terrorist issues. On broader issues, things like the current war across the Lebanese-Israeli border, the Blue Line, in the context of the battles that have been going on daily since October 7th, it's clearly not the case that Iran says, do this, attack here, do that. They don't need to. With Hezbollah in particular, there's this very trusted relationship. Even with Hamas, it appears that the Iranians did not know that this was happening on October 7th. They did not know that it was actually, in fact, going to happen. They knew that there was this notional plan. They knew that for 2 years, because they participated with Islamic Jihad and Hezbollah and Hamas and what they call, this is not my term, their term, an operations room in Beirut for at least 2 years since the last Hamas rocket war with Israel. But they don't require Hamas to report back to them on every little thing. And I think in some cases, post-October 7th, both Iran and Hezbollah are a little bit displeased with exactly how Hamas executed and when it executed and how much foreknowledge they maybe didn't have on the specific go time, given all the consequences it's had for them.
With that having been said, were the October 7th attacks just a case of Hamas lashing out? Or was this part of some bigger, broader plan for events going forward?
October 7th was a carefully thought out and planned, conscious decision. This was not just another rocket attack. I think if you look back 2 years prior to the last Hamas rocket attack with Israel in 2021, there was one more recently, but that was with Islamic Jihad. Maybe that's a better place to start, because with the Islamic Jihad rocket attack, it wasn't clear why Hamas didn't participate. And I think now we can look back and say it's because they knew they had something else planned and they didn't want Israeli reprisal to undermine that. I think when Hamas finished its last rocket war with Israel in 2021, they stood back and they said, this isn't working. If Hamas's only goal was to punch Israel in the nose from time to time and draw blood and feel good about themselves, then this would work. They could prioritize their governance structure in the Gaza Strip, controlling at least part of Palestinian territory. And they could show that they were still tough guys. But give these guys credit. That's not what it's about. They truly believe that they will destroy Israel and establish in its place an Islamist, not a secular, Palestinian state, all of what they consider to be historic Palestine. And if that's the case, then you realize after a succession of rocket wars that you're actually not really damaging Israeli society. You kill a few people, you injure a few people. Israeli society is rebuilt by next Tuesday. Gaza is built back less and less each time because the Europeans and otherwise are figuring out that you're pilfering money intended for rebuilding to build your tunnels, etc. And so they wanted something that was going to completely change the foundations of the relationship. A. B. Why right now? I think it's very, very clear. The prospect of Israeli-Saudi normalization was absolutely anathema to Hamas and by extension Hezbollah and Iran, not only because of the prospect of peace with the custodians of the holiest sites in the Islamic faith, and not only because of the cascading effect that people assumed would come afterwards with other countries, for example, reports coming in now that maybe Indonesia, the most populous Muslim country in the world, would have followed suit, but something more than that. The Saudis were demanding tangible dividends for the Palestinians, moving things toward a two-state solution as a condition for this normalization. And even the Netanyahu government was seriously considering these because of the, you know, ultimate prize of normalization with Saudi Arabia. Now, if you're an average Palestinian, this is a really good thing. If you're Hamas, this is the end of the world. The last thing you want is a two-state solution. Hamas did not carry out October 7th because of occupation. Hamas did not carry out October 7th because of the lack of a two-state solution. Hamas carried out October 7th out of fear that things might be moving towards a two-state solution and sidelining the most militant extremists like itself, Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and Iran. And that's why this axis of Iranian proxies is so activated right now. This is the first time that Iran is able to try, with some success, some real success, put in place the idea of the late Quds Force General Qasem Soleimani of uniting the fronts. I do think, however, Hamas is extremely disappointed. I mean, you can hear Hamas leaders say it themselves, in the response by Hezbollah and others, because they expected it to be not a token response, but a response that would literally lead to the destruction of the state of Israel.
Do you think that Hamas anticipated the heavy-handed response from the Israelis and thought if they could provoke that, it would then force the Iranians and the Houthis and Hezbollah to come in on their side?
I think two things happened. The first is there's no question that the Hamas plan, the strategy, was to draw Israeli forces into Gaza to do something so heinous that the Israelis would have to respond, be drawn in ways they have not since they withdrew from the Gaza Strip in 2005. Remember that Hamas took over the Gaza Strip by force of arms in 2007. Look, that was force of arms targeting fellow Palestinians, not the Israelis. And that they would kill many more Israelis than they've been able to with this urban fighting popping out of tunnels. And they did not expect the kind of assault that the Israelis ultimately did of truly trying to dislodge their governance structure, destroy their military industrial complex, kill as many of their fighters as possible, or that the Israelis would not be deterred from doing so by virtue of Hamas embedding themselves in practically every building and community in the Gaza Strip. But I also think that even though that was absolutely the strategy, that on October 7th itself, they experienced catastrophic success. I don't think that they anticipated that they would encounter as little resistance at the security fence as they did. I don't think they counted on being as successful in taking out remotely controlled machine guns and sensors, etc. I don't think they anticipated that so few soldiers would actually be at the border. I'm uncomfortable using the word successful when you're talking about killing people and raping people, but being this successful and having killed this many people, captured, taken hostage this many people. And I think that that certainly contributed. This was in some ways even worse than what they planned to the Israeli response.
When you look at this network of proxy groups in countries like Syria and Iraq and Lebanon, is there a similarity with what we have in Russia with the Wagner Group, where we saw the Wagner Group operating now in countries in Africa, obviously in Ukraine, and the militia became so big that last year they even attempted to have a mutiny against the Russian army themselves. I mean, is there a risk here that Iran is creating these kind of groups in these neighboring countries that, if and when they choose, could pose a threat to Assad and the rulers in Lebanon and so forth, and ultimately overthrow them and have a Wagner-esque type Iranian group running the country?
I think in many ways, Russia and the Wagner group aspire to achieve what Iran and its proxies have achieved. And they are more effective and they're less costly and they're less politically costly to Iran because they are less formal, right? Wagner became a very, very, very organized, you know, little green men, wink, wink. It wasn't terribly unclear that this was actually Russia. The Iraqi Shia militias, the proxies in Syria, go on down the list. They work very, very closely with the Iranians. There will be Iranian advisors and commanders, but they're not Iranian. And I think what Iran is trying to achieve in these countries is something different. They don't want to overthrow these regimes. They want to control them and, if possible, take them over from within. These are countries that either had already in Gulf states, in Iraq, in Lebanon, sizable Shia populations that they wanted to win over to the Ayatollah's understanding of Shia Islam. And remember that this idea of Waliyat al-Faqih, the rule of the jurisprudent, was an innovation that came with the Iranian Revolution in 1979. And the overwhelming majority of Shia clerics did not believe that clerical rule is what is necessary in Shia Islam. And then in Syria, what they've done is basically imported Shia militants and had them side with the minority Alawite regime. The Alawites consider themselves Shia. Ironically, the Shia generally consider them to be heretics, but there's a political, it's not so much a theological alliance here. And there has been a lot of displacement of non-Shia communities and creation of Shia communities in Syria. I think Iran here wants to create a situation, not where they have to overthrow the Syrian regime, but where the Syrian regime is compliant and where they have sufficient capabilities in Syria, basically to be a frontline state against Israel. And you can see that even just today in terms of the ability to shoot drones into Israel from Syria, not just from Lebanon.
Obviously, Iran has had longstanding conflict with Saudi Arabia itself, although recently that seems to have thawed a little bit. What do you think Iran's view and game plan is towards Saudi Arabia? Do they view it as kind of a bulwark where if they have marginally better relations with Saudi Arabia than Israel does, then in any kind of conflict, Saudi may support them versus Israel? How do you think they view Saudi Arabia at this point?
For decades, there was this very serious competition between the Saudis and Iran as to who would be the kind of international leader for the promulgation of Islamic ideas, Sunni or Shia, around the world. There is an ingrained tension there. Saudi Arabia is the largest, most powerful country in the region, not by population, that's Egypt, but otherwise, and Iran on the other side. Iran wants to kind of contain Saudi, create a situation where they're not at loggerheads, they have diplomatic relations, that Saudi Arabia feels that it's important to maintain those diplomatic relations and therefore is careful about what it will and will not do vis-a-vis Iran. Remember, Iran has supported Shia militants in Saudi Arabia over the years, Hezbollah al-Hejaz, and there have been terrorist attacks, including the one that killed many Americans in Khobar Towers. That tension doesn't go away. But from the Saudi perspective, there's a desire to both try and make nice with Iran on the one hand, and also do what it needs to do to protect itself. That's why the Saudis are so interested in normalization with Israel. It isn't even so much Israel for them. It's the benefits of a defense pact with the United States that would come with that. Remember, it was not very long ago that the Iranians and their proxies shot rockets at Saudi, shot rockets at the UAE. These Gulf countries got the message.
Al-Qaeda is another terrorist group, but it's a Sunni Islam one, as opposed to Iran, which is a Shiite nation. And on paper, the two are diametrically opposed ideologically. Nonetheless, there have been reports that Zawahiri, the former Al-Qaeda leader, may have been hiding in Iran for a period of time. So what is the relationship between Al-Qaeda and the Iranian government?
Al-Qaeda and Iran ideologically hate each other, but they've come to modus vivendi that goes back decades now in terms of my enemy's enemy. 9/11 hijackers were able to fly through Iran, sitting next to or near Hezbollah operatives on planes without needing visas to get into Iran, the 9/11 Commission report noted. Al-Qaeda senior leaders were kept under quote-unquote house arrest in Iran for many years and planned the attack on the residential compounds in Riyadh from Iran. Saif al-Adel, who's believed to be the current head of Al-Qaeda, is still believed to be a resident in Iran. And part of the issue there is that Iran gave these people safe haven when the world is trying to hunt them down. And part of it also is you're not going to carry out attacks here because we are holding on to your wives and your families, etc. There has been situations where the Iranians and Al-Qaeda have cooperated together. Iran and Hezbollah operatives, it's been well documented, provided training and support to the Al-Qaeda East Africa embassy bombers back in 1998, but there's no love lost. In the moment, though, where they deem it necessary, they will cooperate to be able to target their shared enemies in the U.S. and the rest of the West. It goes a little deeper than that in terms of the long-term ability to stay in Iran. They didn't have free reign. They could do whatever they wanted, but it is a complicated relationship, different than the relationship between ISIS, Islamic State, and Iran, which is one that is just antipathy, and ISIS has carried out attacks over the years in Iran.
When you look at Iran geographically, obviously it's got Pakistan and Afghanistan right next door where ISIS are active, who have targeted Iran. You have this shaky relationship between Iran and Al-Qaeda, but you also have separatist groups seemingly operating out of Pakistan against the Iranian regime. With this sort of mixture of terrorist groups, militants, separatists, is there a danger for Iran that you could have a situation as you had in Syria, where all these conflicting forces kind of blow up on their doorstep and then get sucked into Iran and cause the regime there to collapse?
So we're overlaying multiple issues here. Along the border with Pakistan is part of Iran where there are a lot of Sunnis, and it's also Iranian Baluchistan. You can go back to the early 1970s and the Baluch Rebellion to kind of get a sense of things long before there was any talk of Al-Qaeda or anything like that. There are groups like Jindallah and others that are believed to have some ties to Al-Qaeda, but ultimately are really more Sunni, Baluchi fundamentalist groups than they are international Al-Qaeda groups. And the reality is that Iran is a police state. And so there are incidents that happen. There's drug smuggling that happens. The Iranian authorities are busy there. From time to time, there'll be an Iranian IRGC, a siege, or other official who's killed. There are attacks from time to time, but it doesn't seem to be something that has the kind of staying power as what we've seen in other places, in part because Syria was a much, much weaker state. And Iran is a more powerful state and a more powerful police state.
Since October 7th, because the United States and to an extent Britain and other countries have in various ways seemed to support Israel, either, you know, with weapons or financially or just spoken out in support to a degree, some of their actions, there's been a lot of talk inevitably from the Middle East about, you know, hostility to those countries. We know in the past and even recently, Iranian agents have committed terrorist attacks, have committed or attempted to commit assassinations in these countries. Do you think, though, that October 7th could prove a trigger for, if there's a network of Iranian sleepers out there suddenly getting the go-ahead and saying, right, now's the time to strike?
So first, I would challenge the premise of the question in terms of tying this to October 7th, and even more fundamentally, tying the Israeli onslaught to October 7th. It's important to note the Israeli onslaught came 2 weeks after October 7th because a lot of the anti-Semitism and the types of violence that we've seen around the world predated even the Israeli entry into the war. It was never just about that. But the issue of the Iranian international operations is one that I've spent a lot of time studying. We're about to launch an interactive map of this activity around the world. I've written a bunch of articles documenting it in great detail. It long, long predates October 7th in its most current incarnation. And the bottom line is it goes back to 1979, almost consistent over time with a few rare pauses, like right after 9/11, where Iran and its proxies didn't want to be seen as part of what we were then calling the global war on terrorism. This is something that the Iranians have found is fairly cost-free, as long as it can be done in what they would consider to be reasonably deniable ways. Doesn't mean that they don't think we know. It's just that we don't know well enough in a way we can declassify publicly enough to be able to go to war with Iran. The bottom line for Iran is they will fight to the last Arab. They will fight to the last non-Iranian Shia militant from Afghanistan or Pakistan or elsewhere. They do not want this fight, meaning fight over assassination of U.S. officials in retaliation for the killing of Qasem Soleimani, their efforts to target dissidents around the world, their support for militants in the region, October 7th, all of this, so long as it doesn't come back within Iran's borders, they're okay with it. Iran and its proxies hit U.S. forces in Syria and Iraq 170 times, and we have not responded in Iran. We've responded against mostly their proxies, but a couple of Iranians in Syria and Iraq, they're fine with that. The international operations is something that I think they're still trying to figure out where the red lines are. You know, they are really serious about wanting to exact revenge for the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, but I think they understand that they do that if they are successful there, even if they do it in a reasonably deniable way, we're going to know and we're going to respond. And they're trying to figure that out at all times. But these plots are ongoing literally right now as you and I are speaking here. This interactive map that we're publishing in a couple of weeks is already getting a lot of attention with people who are getting a sneak peek at it.
Do you think that we, meaning in the West, should be taking stronger action against the Iranian regime? Or is there a fear that after what we saw play out in Iraq when we removed Saddam, and in Libya with Gaddafi, that if we were to try and topple the Iranian regime, something potentially even worse could rise up in its place.
There certainly is an element of bad experience, and you break it, you own it. There also is the realization that Iran is a very, very big country, and there is the irony that it seems pretty clear that the majority of the people in Iran are not particularly enamored by the Ayatollahs. You know, with pressuring people and threatening people, it looks like they got 40-something percent people to vote in their latest sham election. The demographics don't seem to support the longevity of this regime. But there's also the reality that here in the United States, there's not a whole lot that Democrats and Republicans really agree on. One thing they do agree on is the desire not to get involved in another big Middle East war and the need to pivot to Asia and to realign our capabilities away from counterterrorism being the number one threat towards great power competition. And there's a lot of logic to that. The 20 years investment in counterterrorism kept the country safe, but it's become unsustainable financially, and it is not addressing the threats that could potentially pose existential threats to the United States. Terrorism is horrific. Terrorism is scary, but terrorism is not an existential threat. But the kind of challenges we face from Russia and China in particular are more significant. Now, there's a significant area of Venn diagram overlap between great power competition and counterterrorism. Counterterrorism is currency for a lot of currencies that want our support there, and where we want from them dividends on great power competition. Think of African countries, for example. But it's also the case that if you don't visit the Middle East will visit you. That's what we found on October 7th, where the U.S. had reassigned so many people from the Middle East and from counterterrorism to Asia, great power competition in China and Russia. Come October 7th, there was a scramble to figure out, okay, who's going to do what? We suddenly have to pivot back to the Middle East. And there's one last thing that I think is really important to consider there. Part of the whole intellectual grounding for this shift is moving from the 20 years of U.S.-led, partner-enabled efforts to keep the world safe, flipping that in its head and saying wherever possible, partners should lead, and we're happy to help. So Libya, that should be a European lead, and let us know how we can help. And part of that was shifting towards greater focus on indicators and warning. So I don't need to be all places all the time. And when you have allies that are better placed to be experts on something, then maybe I don't need to be. Well, Israel is the number one expert on Hamas. And we followed Hamas in the United States, but it wasn't a top tier for us because Hamas isn't carrying out operations in the United States other than fundraising primarily. Until recently, it wasn't carrying out plots around the world. There are a couple of plots in Europe just thwarted. It's not clear if that's going to be the new normal or not. But the Israelis certainly were. And even the Israelis were caught off guard here, which means we got to rethink a little bit how we rely on others and what we require ourselves to do, what the best balance is as we shift resources away from counterterrorism. And at the same time, demand of the counterterrorism people the ability to get even better at indicators and warning, which ultimately is asking them to do more with less.
Away from the Middle East, we've seen Iran providing weaponry, drones specifically, to Russia for the war in Ukraine. And there's been a closeness between those two countries to a degree, cooperating in Syria previously. And we also have this tight connection between China and Russia. Is there a danger here that something akin to, you know, what George Bush described as the supposed axis of evil between Iran, Iraq, and North Korea could form here, to where Russia, China, and Iran, despite differences, their interests coalesce, and as a group, they become a serious threat to the United States and to the Western countries?
So again, I don't much like terms like axis of evil, not only because they kind of sound too James Bondish, but because they put the world into pretty little boxes that don't reflect reality. We in the West tend to do that a lot to our detriment. The reality is that for all the ideological differences between communist China and Russia and Shia fundamentalist Iran, they work quite well together. Iran and China on economic issues, including joint efforts to undermine international sanctions regimes and authorities. Iran does the same with Russia on sanctions, but Iran has a very different budding security relationship with Russia that was tested and proved very effective in Syria. And now when Russia needs to go to the third world, to the Iran and North Koreas of the world, to get rockets and drones to fire at Ukrainian civilian targets, these weaker partners have stepped up. And that has put Iran in a particular place of importance for Russia. Iran has demonstrated its reliability as a security partner. We're talking not just about drones, and I've actually seen, picked up and touched the remnants of Iranian drones recovered from battlefields in the Middle East. And in Ukraine, you can see that it's the exact same thing, the Shahed 101, the Shahed 131, but also rockets now as well, according to European officials. That doesn't need to translate into ideology as long as it doesn't undermine or interfere with one another's most fundamental beliefs. There's a whole lot of, again, Venn diagram overlap that works very, very well with them. So we in the West tend to feel most comfortable only partnering with countries that are just like us. Elsewhere in the world, countries are very happy to figure out there's lots about you I don't like and lots about me that you don't like, but there's lots of shared interest and they do a lot of effective work in that space. And we need to come to terms with that to be able to counter it.
Matthew, thank you so much for your insight. It's been really eye-opening talking to you. And in the next episode, I delve more deeply, specifically, into the ongoing conflict in Israel and the Palestinian territories.